Good morning and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live for a half hour each weekday morning to take your calls and to attempt to answer whatever questions you may raise about the Bible or the Christian faith. Those questions that you've had rolling around in your head, maybe for years, or maybe just since the last time you read the Bible. In fact, that might have been years ago, too. But if you were just reading the Bible this morning and ran across something perplexing, well, then you have something you could call us about, and we could talk about it. It's possible that it's something I have thought about and looked into myself and might be able to give you some insight into. If not, maybe some other listener will have those insights, which means that this host does not pretend to have the last word on any of the questions in the Bible. And if you have heard something this host has said that you disagree with, you're welcome to call and balance comment with what you see in the Scriptures so we can have an open discussion about what the Bible teaches based on your questions and also your insights. The number to call if you'd like to be on the program is 1-800-227-5278. That's 1-800-227-5278. Our first caller today is Pete, who's calling from Riverside, California. Pete, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you for accepting my call. My question today is, who actually wrote the Bible? I know it was basically men, but how is this possible?
Well, the Bible was written by quite a few men, probably
exactly.
about 40 authors. We know of about 40 who contributed. And they wrote it over a long period of time. There was not some kind of a committee that got together and said, well, you write these books, I'll write these books, and we'll put together a Bible. What it was over the centuries, God sent his messengers, the prophets, to Israel. And some of them wrote down what God had to say, and some of them didn't. But there were prophets who didn't write anything, like Elijah and Elisha didn't write any books as far as we know. But prophets like Moses and Samuel and David and Solomon and Isaiah and those people, in their lifetimes, they wrote what God revealed to them for the sake of God's people to know the mind of God. There were also false prophets, and they sometimes may have written things. We don't have their writings preserved because they came to be recognized as false prophets. If they predicted things that didn't come true, or they spoke against the true God, which prophets of Baal or prophets of Moloch might do, false prophets. Well, the Jews didn't preserve their writings because they were not recognized as authentic. So the authentic writings of authentic prophets were preserved by the Jewish community and become what we call the Old Testament books. The New Testament, on the other hand, preserves the writings of the apostles of Jesus. And we don't have all of their writings. For example, Paul, we know, wrote at least one or two other letters that he alludes to in the letters of his that we have. But those letters have been lost. For example, there was a first letter to the Corinthians before our letter, 1 Corinthians, and Paul mentions it in 1 Corinthians 5:9 that he had written a previous letter, but no one has that letter. So not everything they wrote was preserved, but all the things that they wrote that were preserved in a collection for the church because they were from the apostles of Jesus Christ. Jesus appointed the apostles to speak for him authoritatively, and so that's why their writings were preserved. And that's the New Testament.
Some of the things I understand too is that they had people that used to write things, and then they used to put on the names of these other people, like disciples, to their documents as if it was written by a disciple. Is that correct?
That is true. There are what were called pseudepigraphal writings, where somebody wrote anonymous, somebody whose name we don't know, wrote a book and put the name of somebody that is known upon it. So you've got books like the Gospel of Peter and the Apocalypse of Peter and the Gospel of Thomas and the Gospel of Judas and the Gospel of Mary and things like that. These books, however, were never accepted because they did exactly what you said. Somebody else wrote the book and falsely put the name of someone famous on the book. And because the books were not really written by those people, they were never preserved in the Bible. In fact, we wouldn't even know about most of those books, except that some of the church fathers in the 2nd and 3rd century mentioned them, and a collection of those false books have been found in the 1940s in the deserts of Egypt. The Nag Hammadi Library was discovered, had a lot of these books in it. But these books had already been mentioned in the 2nd and 3rd century by the church fathers. We just didn't have copies of them until they were discovered in modern history. But they were excluded from the New Testament because they weren't written by the people whose names are on them.
Okay. Well, Steve, thank you very much. That's my question completely.
All right, Pete, thanks for your call. Good talking to you.
Good talking to you.
Bye now. Oops, I didn't mean to hang up on you before you're done. Our next caller is Steve from Kamiai, Idaho. And it's great to hear from you, Steve. How you doing?
I'm doing good, brother. I got
long
a question.
Long time no hear.
Yeah. I don't think I've called maybe one other time when I first met you. But, hey, I got a question for you. And I'm going to email you. But today I decided to call you because I think it's really interesting. The difference between faith and hope. It seems like, first, of course, we know Corinthians tells us the greatest is love, but it doesn't mean that hope isn't great. And also, how do you reconcile the fact that in Hebrews, faith is the substance of things hoped for, and that is used in the same way in the same scripture as faith. So how do you reconcile the fact that in one area they're used independently, or shown to be independent, in another area they're used collectively? Could you talk about that for a little bit?
Well, yeah, in 1 Corinthians 13:13, Paul says that three things abide: faith and hope and love. So they are, hope and faith are bundled together in a list of things that abide, that are permanent things, along with love. Whereas in Hebrews 11:1, it says faith is the evidence of things not seen. It's the substance of things hoped for. I believe that in both those places, hope and faith are distinguished from each other, but they are related to each other too, just as faith and love are related to each other, but they're distinguished. Like Paul said in Galatians 5:6, what matters to God is a faith that works through love. So you've got faith and love in the same sentence. In fact, they have a relationship to each other, but they're different things. Faith works through love. If you have faith in God, then you allow yourself to work in a loving way. Your works are going to be works of love. But they're not the same thing. They function together. And faith is the substance of things hoped for. Now, hoped for means their future. The very meaning of hope is that you're looking forward to something that's not yet happened. In fact, Paul says in Romans, if you already have it, why would you hope for it? It's by definition, hope is something off in the future, something desirable in the future. In our case, the Christian hope is the appearing of the glory of our great God and Savior, Jesus Christ. Paul said in Titus 2:13, that's our blessed hope. And since that hasn't happened yet, we look forward to that. And there's many things associated with that that are part of our hope also. So the hope is what we're looking forward to. Now, faith is the substance of that. And I think what it means is that we have faith in those things that are hoped for. We believe the promise of God before it materializes. And that makes those things substantial even now. Faith is the substance of those things. Those things will become realities in due time. They are future. But right now we can embrace them as if they were substantial because we believe the promises about them. So even though I haven't seen the resurrection of the dead, I can embrace the hope or the fact of the resurrection of the dead before it happens by faith. And that means that, if the loved ones I have who've died, I can enjoy the fact that I will see them again because my faith gives some kind of substance to that future hoped-for thing. If I didn't believe the promises of God, then those things would be ethereal. They would not be substantial. I couldn't embrace them in any way. So faith lays hold on those things that are hoped for in the future. It doesn't make them actually happen any faster. It just gives me an experience of those things now. That is the comfort of them and the enjoyment of them, in a sense. I can enjoy because I really believe those things. Because I really believe Jesus is coming back, I can live with the joy of that now, as if it was substantial already. Now, hope, therefore, is always about the future. Faith is about is more of a present thing. Faith has to do with essentially trust in somebody. In our case, it's trust in God. We trust God's promises. We trust his character. And that's why we trust his promises, because we do trust his character. We figure he's honest. So that's good character, and we believe him. So we trust his promises. So faith is really what characterizes our relationship to God, and for that matter to some other people too, but not in the same degree. We trust God completely. We trust our wives and we trust our friends, perhaps to a slightly lesser degree, but we still trust them. Trust is what is necessary in a relationship with a person of any kind, and certainly in a relationship with God. If we don't trust him, we won't know anything about the invisible realm.
We surely won't have much hope if we don't trust him, do we?
Exactly. Exactly. If we're not sure that he told the truth when he promised certain things, then we don't really have any substantial hope at all. So faith gives substance to the things that are hoped for. But faith we have now.
I wanted you to kind of take that on the air because it's interesting. I Googled. I wanted to get a few opinions, you know, because it's obviously futuristic. And you know, Romans 5 talks about, you know, the suffering that we go through. You know, we're not ashamed because of the hope, you know. And yet it's amazing that everybody dwells on faith and love, but not as much on hope. But that's really what Paul talks about in 1 Corinthians 15, that if we have hope in this life only, we're most miserable above all men. And it seems
hope
like everybody...
Hope is the basis,
you know,
of our endurance.
Yeah. And it helps us run the race, and I wanted you to kind of go over that in the air because, you know me, I'm going to get a hold of you to kind of explain things. And so I thought, well, I'll just do it on the air because I just want it to be out there more, and you explained it really well, really well. I really appreciate it. I'm actually preaching at a church camp this week. I'm going to preach on hope. And,
oh, great.
Yeah, looking forward to that. So,
are you preaching at Alaca?
No, I am, of course, I'm going to a different church now, and they have a church camp up the river at on the Locksaw, a real nice facility, and I'm going to be speaking there, and so I'm looking forward to that. So I'm going to speak on hope, because I very rarely hear a message on that, so
I want to
do that. Thank you, Steve. I don't want to take your time, but I look forward to talking to you again and seeing you someday soon.
All right. Say hi to my friends, your neighbors.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. God bless you. Bye now. Many years ago, I lived in Idaho, and Steve was he was at that time the postmaster of Kami, Idaho. He's retired now. But he also was the founder of the church I attended. It started in his home, but it grew so large they had to move it out. It was one of my very favorite churches that I've ever belonged to. And so it's good to hear from him. I don't know that he's ever called on the air before. John from Los Angeles, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling. John? Going once? Going twice? John? Okay, it looks like we have lost John, unfortunately. Call back if you'd like. We'd love to talk to you, John. Let's talk to David from Los Angeles, see how we do here. David, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks for taking the call. I have a question in regards to Joshua 7. You know, when Achan took the Babylonian garment and the 200 shekels of silver.
Yes.
And my question is, right here, Achan was the one who sinned. How come they killed, you know, their sons and daughters and everything, and they burned it out?
Right. Yeah, when Achan was caught in his crime and put to death for it, his whole family was put to death with him, which seems strange,
right?
Because in the law of Moses, it says that a son will not be put to death for his father's sins, and a father will not be put to death for his son's sins. So it's very clearly taught in the law and also later in Scripture, in Ezekiel 18, you know, the soul that sins, it will die. The father will not die for his son's sins. The son will not die for his father's sins. And yet we have here Achan committing a sin, and his sons and whole family are put to death with him. This, if we picture his family as consisting of a number of small children, and if we picture that they were put to death with him, that would certainly seem unfair. On the other hand, remember, his crime was he stole something from God, really, something that was dedicated to God, and he hid it in his tent where his family lived. There's certainly his family knew it was there. They lived in the tent. It wasn't like they had multi-rooms, dwellings. And his sons may very well have been adult sons. In other words, they may have been complicit with him. That is to say, he did the crime, but they were accessories to the crime. We don't know this to be true, but we don't know it not to be true. And since God has expressed in the law that he does not approve of putting children to death for the father's crimes, on this occasion where these sons had to be put to death too, we have to assume they were accessories to the crime. They were involved in the crime too. Because God...
Pretty much they were adults, though. The demon was like a 6, 5 years old kid.
Right. We don't actually know what age his sons were, but we don't know that they weren't adults. They could well have been adults or you know, older adolescents, and therefore the whole family was in on the theft, and that would justify, of course, that all the members of the family are treated to the same punishment because they're all involved in the same crime.
So it looked like pretty much they got involved in that, and then same thing right with him.
Well, I'm simply deducing this. We don't have any more information than that which you read in the page, and we're not told anything about the age of his children or any of that. I'm just saying that in principle, God is opposed to having innocent family members punished for the crimes of their father or whatever. And since God did have them all punished, we have to assume that none of the family members were innocent.
Okay.
I mean, if you robbed a bank and brought the money home, and your teenage sons and wife were all in on it, and you're all keeping it a big secret and all enjoying the heist, when you get caught, you all go to jail, or you all suffer the consequences because you're all responsible adults involved in the crime. That's what I assume to be the case in Achan's family.
So pretty much he got him involved, though. Probably.
Well, honestly, like I said, we don't know any more than what's there. I'm reading between the lines based on what I know God commanded, God commanded that this whole family be punished, whereas he elsewhere commanded that, innocent parties of family would not be punished. So they're not innocent. That seems to be a given. They're all old enough to be responsible and to be punished for the crime.
Okay.
We could, if we thought otherwise, I mean, we could speculate otherwise. We could speculate that these were toddler children and that God just on this occasion wanted the toddler children stoned to death. But that doesn't sound very much like God. It doesn't sound like the law of God. It sounds like it would go against
him. Right.
Because
when I was reading it, that was my thinking. I go, like, how come little kids, paying for a consent too?
Right. I don't think they did. I don't think little kids did.
Okay, thanks. Thank you very much, Steve, for your help.
Okay, David. Good talking to you. Bye now.
Have a good one. Bye-bye.
All right, our lines are clear. We had at one point John from L.A. on, but when we activated his call, he wasn't there, and now we have our lines empty. We only have a few minutes, but we actually do have, 7 or 8 minutes, so if you want to give me a call, the number is 1-800-227-5278. It's 1-800-227-5278. My name is Steve Gregg. This show is called The Narrow Path. Every weekday at this same time, we have a half hour together live to take your calls and discuss the issues you raise. I have a second program every day also. I do two programs a day. The afternoon program is an hour long. Same kind of program, same name, The Narrow Path in both cases, and they're both live. So in the morning I do a half hour, in the afternoon I do an hour. However, the stations that carry the half hour don't carry the hour, and the stations that carry the hour don't carry the half hour. So you would not be able to listen to both programs in your listening area, but you can hear them both from our website. If you would like to hear the programs, either live or later, they are archived there. The website is thenarrowpath.com. It's that simple, thenarrowpath.com. And if you go to the website, there's actually a lot of resources there. Nothing is for sale. It's all free. We don't have any sponsors. We don't sell anything. Our website doesn't allow any advertising banners or anything like that. We just have stuff there for free. And what we have a number of things, but what we mostly have are MP3 files you can download of lectures, of Bible studies on everything conceivable, including verse by verse through all the books of the Bible and some hundreds of topics as well. All free. Check it out. It's at thenarrowpath.com. Let's talk to Fred from Costa Mesa, California. Fred, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes, I was listening to the last answer you said about, we don't pay for our father's sin, or the father doesn't pay for the son's sin. Then why are we paying for Adam's sin?
I don't believe we are.
Oh,
I mean, we do live in a fallen world. We do live in a fallen world that came about because of Adam's sin. In that sense, I guess we all pay for it. The same as if, let's say, a man wasted all of his family's money in gambling, and they lost their home, and the whole family was homeless. You could say that the father's sin had brought a disaster in the living circumstances of his entire family. And they would be, in that sense, paying for his mistakes. But if we're talking about paying in the sense that God is punishing, I think it's not the case that we're punished for Adam's sin. I think we're punished for our own sins.
Okay. I mean, I wasn't really asked to be brought into the world. I mean, it's good
right.
that I'm here. The thing, because I like to think positive most of the time, and I think that everything is good. Adam screwed up and made a bad choice, and it seems like the whole world is paying for it.
I hear you. Well, it's like I said, we're like the children of a man who went and wasted the family money, and now we live in an alley.
I guess that makes sense.
Right, but when it comes to ultimate standing before God, now that's another story. It's one thing to live your life in a fallen world. It's another thing to go off and have a different kind of destiny after you die in the resurrection. And there are many people who think that we are actually alienated from God in such a way as a person would go to hell. Like a baby would go to hell if they die because they're guilty of Adam's sin, and therefore they're punished for what Adam did in that way. I don't believe the Bible teaches that. I believe the Bible teaches that we will perish for our own sins. We will have a worse living condition in this world because of Adam's sin, but in terms of eternal things and our relationship with God, I don't think God holds Adam's sin against us.
Okay.
He wouldn't need to. And even if he did, it would only be so for a short time, because before long we're doing our own sins. It's not like someone lives a long time without sinning. So, God could hold our own sins against us soon enough. But I don't think he holds a father's sins against the child.
Okay.
All right, Fred, I appreciate your call. I'm sorry, I thought we were done. I hit the button. I didn't mean to cut you off. Let's talk to Gary from Whittier, and we're just about out of time here. Gary, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks. Real brief here. Do you see Israel becoming a nation in 1948? Do you see that as a divine act of the promise of God, or is that part of judgment? Because back in 1 Samuel 8, they've always wanted a man and be a nation, just like all the other Gentile nations. How do you respond to that? I'd like to hear your answer, and I'll hang up. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thanks for your call. 1948, Israel was recognized by the United Nations as a nation on May 14th. And many Christians believe this is an important fulfillment of Bible prophecy, signaling the end of the age of the last days. All I can say is, if it fulfills some promise or some Bible prophecy, I don't know what promise that is. And I say that as somebody who has changed his mind on this very point. I certainly taught and believed, as my teachers taught and believed. For many years, I taught that this was a fulfillment of prophecy. Then I went looking for the prophecy that it was fulfilling and couldn't find it anywhere. In the entire Bible, I don't know of any prophecy that is given that can be said to be fulfilled in 1948. Now, if someone says, but it certainly is a divine act, well, I could allow that. I mean, I don't know if it is or not. Things do happen probably in the will of God and out of the will of God, depending on how Calvinistic you are. But the truth is that I believe that God does raise up kings and bring down kings. I believe God does raise up nations and bring down nations. That doesn't mean that the raising up of a nation, when it happens, is something that was predicted. For example, I certainly believe that God raised up the United States. I believe that this is, and many other nations too. I don't think just us. I think that God raises nations up. The Bible says he raised up Babylon and then took it down and raised up the Persians and took them down. I believe that God raises up and brings down. But that doesn't mean that there's anything in the Bible that predicted the rise of the United States or of the modern state of Israel. All the predictions about the reestablishment of the Jews in their land and gathering them from all the nations and restoring them as a nation, all the predictions in the Bible on that were made before the end of the Babylonian exile. In other words, the predictions were made, and then the exile ended, and those predictions were fulfilled. After that, no more predictions of that type were made. So I don't know of any prophecy that can be said to have been necessarily fulfilled in 1948. I appreciate the call. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. We are listener-supported. If you go to our website, you can find out how to keep us on the air. The website is thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for calling and listening. God bless you.
You've been listening to The Narrow Path here on AM 740 KBright. This program has made such a great impact in the Christian community, and we need, Steve, we need these types of answers to the questions that you have that crop up when you're on a spiritual journey. And if you would like to be able to continue to hear this program on KBright, please go to Steve's website and give as generously as you can. That website is thenarrowpath.com. That's thenarrowpath.com. And we do thank you for supporting this God-honoring ministry. The views and opinions on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Crawford Broadcasting Company, its ownership, management, or its advertisers. Joyce Meyer is next on AM 740 KBright.
Long Beach, California. Get ready for a weekend full of excitement, powerful worship, and messages that will change your life. It's all part of the Joyce Meyer Ministries Conference Tour that's coming August 22nd through the 24th. Join thousands at the Giant Center. Be led in worship by contemporary Christian artist Bill Wickham. And hear New York Times best-selling author and practical Bible teacher Joyce Meyer.
I said, even while you're maturing and changing, you can enjoy your imperfect self. I said, you can enjoy your imperfect self.
The best part is, admission is free. Sessions begin Thursday night, August 22nd. Just call 1-866-C-JOYCE or check out joycemeyer.org for all the details.
The oldest and largest Christian station in Southern California, 50,000 watts strong. KBRT and KBRT HD Costa Mesa, and on the web at KBRT740.com.
Welcome to Enjoying Everyday Life with New York Times bestselling author Joyce Meyer. On today's program, Joyce will be teaching from her series entitled Battlefield of the Mind. Everything that you say and do begins with the thoughts in your mind.
Right now, as you are listening, you are thinking about something. Maybe it's about work or family. Maybe it's the ever-looming question of the future. As you think to yourself, where else do your thoughts go? Do you fear, get angry, feel depressed, or worry about failure? These are all tactics that Satan uses to distract your mind from the peace and courage that God can provide. Stay tuned as Joyce discusses the battles that you face in your mind and how God can help you have victory over these and other attacks. Now, here's Joyce with today's teaching, Battlefield of the Mind.
Deuteronomy chapter 1, verse 20. And I said to you, you have come to the hill country of the Ammonites, which the Lord your God gives us. This is Moses saying this. Behold, the Lord your God has set the land before you. Go up and possess it. And the Lord, the God of your fathers, has said to you, fear not, neither be dismayed. Then you all came near to me and said, let us send men before us that they may search out the land, that they may bring us word again by which way we should go up and into what cities we shall come. And the thing pleased me well, and I took 12 men of you, and I sent you in. These are what we call the 12 spies who went in to check out the promised land. And sure enough, verse 25 says, they took of the fruit of the land in their hands and brought it down to us and brought us word again and said, it is a good land which the Lord your God gives us. Watch verse 26. Yet you would not go up, but you rebelled against the commandment of the Lord. Now, I don't have time to go through all this, but later they decided, well, now we will go up.